on in this series in the book of Acts. The book of Acts, I think, is shaped in particular by two verses very early on in the book. Acts chapter 1, verse 8, it's the promise and the command of Jesus. Jesus said this to his followers, "You will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the very ends of the earth." And so the book of Acts is the story of how God carried on taking his gospel, the gospel with the message of Jesus, to the far extents of the Roman world. That is the book of Acts. Much of the book focuses on the part that the apostle Paul played in taking the message of Jesus outside of Jewish territory, Israel, and to the further reaches of Europe and Asia. Jesus basically said of Paul, his name was Saul, a Roman named Paul, when Jesus met him and he was converted, Jesus said of the guy who came to meet him, he was a bit fearful about going to see this guy Saul, because this guy Saul was renowned and known for persecuting Christians. This is what Jesus said to that guy who went to meet him. He said that Paul is my chosen instrument to carry my name before Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. That's Acts chapter 9, verse 15. So Jesus said, this guy, Paul, is the guy I'm going to use to take my message out to the wider world, to kings, to rulers of nations, and also to my people, the Jews, to Israel. And so here at the end of Paul's third missionary journey, he thinks he's got a fourth missionary journey. He doesn't realize it's his last. He's going to Jerusalem, just as he knew Jesus would want him to do, to preach the gospel there. And from there he's going to Rome. And from there he'd hope to go to Spain as well. And as we engage with this part of the book of Acts, the tension in our minds, the question in our minds, the tension as we read this part of the book ought to be, will Paul ever get to Rome? Because at this point, as we've been looking at the story last week and then 2 weeks before that, it just seemed like he would never get there. All sorts of things were in his way. Keep your place there in the book of Acts and just flick with me to Romans chapter 15. Paul wrote to the church in Rome he asked them to pray for him and about the journey that we're reading about in the book of Acts. He said, pray for me as I go to Jerusalem, then pray for me as I hope to come to you. So page 1144, Romans chapter 15 and verses 30 to 32. Here's what Paul said to the church in Rome. I appeal to you, brothers, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God on my behalf. Please note the prayer triplet that is involved when we begin to pray to God about mission work. My brothers, I appeal to you by our Lord Jesus Christ, by the love of the Spirit, the Son, the Spirit, and to engage with God the Father in prayers on my behalf. What a prayer triplet that works for us. That, verse 31, I may be delivered from the unbelievers in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints, so that by God's will I may come to you with joy and be refreshed in your company. May the God of peace be with you all. Amen. The question is, will God answer that prayer? It's deep in the passion of Paul's heart, isn't it? He really wants the people in Rome to engage with God, Father, Son, and Spirit for him, in the hope that he will be able to get there and have his own heart refreshed when he does get there. And we ask the question in Acts, will that prayer be answered? Well, look at our passage, Acts 23. Look at verse 11. It gives us a great clue that it may well be answered. But Jesus comes to Paul in the night. Paul is bruised and battered, and no doubt he's feeling emotionally tender. And there in the night, Jesus stands by him and says, verse 11, take courage, for as you testify to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify about me in Rome. So Paul, all that he has is the word of Jesus and the encouragement of Jesus to take courage and to keep going. On the face of it, there's nothing on his side. Nothing to get him to Rome other than Jesus. Jesus' word and Jesus being with him. Ultimately, the book of Acts is Acts chapter 1, verse 1. Luke says to Theophilus, who he's writing Acts 4, he says, "In my first book, the book of Luke, Theophilus, I told you all that Jesus began to do." And so he's really saying this second book is all that Jesus continued to do. Fit that with verse 8 of chapter 1, "The power of the Spirit will come upon you, you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth." Basically, the book of Acts is the work of Jesus by the power of the Spirit through his people. So as we focus on this section tonight, just want to just draw our minds and our hearts to Jesus, to his work, to his control over what is going on. The first thing I want to draw out is Jesus at work despite our angry reactions. And that's verses 1 to 5. But just engage with me where the story's got to. We can feel for the commander, that Roman tribune. We come across him last week and a couple of weeks before that. He keeps on having to save Paul from being lynched. Everywhere Paul goes, people try to beat him up. And this Roman commander can't figure out why and what's going on. And he keeps on, and the phrase is, I keep on hearing it on various news programs at the moment. They talk about the economy and people need to drill down into the figures to see what's going on. This Roman tribune is trying to drill down to get to the truth of what's going on. And he just can't get there, you know. And one minute he's trying to get some information from a great crowd. And one lot's shouting one thing, another lot's shouting something else, and the other guys just want to lay in the Paul and kill him. Well, there's nothing there. So he thinks, well, I might try, I'll flog him and torture him and see if I can get something. And then he realizes, oh, I can't do that. He's a Roman citizen. And so each time he can't get down to the facts. And we've got to feel for him, because I think he is a man of integrity, although if we look closely at his letter to Felix, which comes at the end of our chapter, he does fib a little bit. He says, I discovered that Paul was a Roman citizen and then I decided to save him. No, that's not what happened. Basically, he's a man of integrity. And we can feel for him and what he's trying to do. And so he has a new brainwave at the end of chapter 22. He decides that what he will do is this, in verse 30 of the previous chapter, he says, I'll get the Jewish council together and they can interrogate Paul. They can kind of put him on trial. And all I need to do is turn up and listen. And they're in the context of a legal situation. We'll have some sensible questions asked. We'll have some sensible answers given. And we've got various lawyers in the congregation here tonight who might go to, you know, a court of law. And you'd expect the judge to act honorably and everyone to honor the judge. And that's the kind of situation that he's expecting. And he can listen in and make his decision as a result. If he's expecting an orderly investigation, though, things go terribly wrong near the beginning. Look at what Paul says. Paul opens up in verse 1. Looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers. So he carries on being kind-hearted and gracious and humble towards people that want his blood. Brothers, he says, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. That's a really good start, isn't it? You wish that you could say something like that about your life? And you think, well, the Roman tribune is thinking, well, this is all going to go very well. But what happens next? We would never have believed. This is a court of law. And the guy in charge, the high priest, says to some of those folks near Paul, would one of you smack him in the gob? That's exactly what happened. Someone hit him in the mouth. So, boom. Someone smacks him in the face. Why? Where did that come from? We're not told any more than that's just what happens. Paul, how does Paul react? Well, I've tried to draw attention to the fact the way that Paul's time in Jerusalem and is heading towards Jerusalem is incredibly similar to Jesus heading towards Jerusalem in Luke's first book, Luke. And Jesus, we know from the Gospels, took a smash right in the face in the same court. And he responded graciously without saying anything. We know from Isaiah, before a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. That was Jesus. And up until now, we found the Apostle Paul following Jesus' example until now. Now, I might be wrong, but I think Paul loses it. I think he gets angry. He doesn't say anything untrue. He says, all that he says is absolutely spot on, but I think he loses it. I think he bites back with angry irony and sarcasm. Basically says, you whitewashed wall. You hypocrites. You stand here saying that you stand for the laws of God and you smack me in the face. You hypocrite. And those standing here said, can you really treat the high priest like that? And Paul says, well, sorry, I didn't know it was the high priest. Now, some people say it's because Paul was really short-sighted. I take my glasses off right now, and you're generally a smudge. Although I can generally, this is Josh, but I know because I saw him sat while I had my glasses on. Some people think he was short-sighted. Well, he was short-sighted. We know from Galatians that Paul probably was short-sighted and think, well, that's what was going on here. He couldn't see that was the high priest. Other people say, well, I don't know, he might have been wearing the equivalent to a baseball cap and jeans, the high priest, you know, wearing his kind of like civvies. But no. I think what goes on is, well, look at verse 5. I think when they said to him, you know, should you talk to the high priest like this? I think verse 5, Paul is basically saying, I gladly submit to the true leader of God's people. But a true leader of God's people wouldn't break God's law, especially in this context, supposedly defending it. I think he's just a caustic irony and anger and sarcasm. And what he says is absolutely true. I don't know, let's hit the pause button on the story and let me ask us. Have you ever felt that you've blown your witness because you've argued or lost your cool? You know, you've been wanting to tell your friend about Jesus. They've come back with some stuff and they've been a bit angry with you, and then you've come back angry with them, and then you thought, oh no. And you've gone home and you think, what a prat. Jesus is at work despite our angry reactions. The evening after these events, Jesus comes, look at verse 11, and says to Paul, take courage. Take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Perhaps that's a word for some of us here tonight. Let's move to the next thing. Jesus is at work despite our dangerous tactics. That's verses 6 to 10. Paul seizes the initiative in the context of this court of law. And he now questions whether the council are all brothers. In verse 1, he calls them brothers. In verse 6, he calls them all brothers. But then he says, it raises a question, which kind of like, are we all brothers? You see some lot over here, and they are Pharisees. And the Pharisees believed in the resurrection of the dead. And over here, there's a whole bunch of Sadducees who didn't believe in the resurrection. And some of you went to Sunday school, and you know this because there's the phrase that we all learned when we were little in Sunday school. If you went to Sunday school, is the reason why we know the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection is because they were so... Well, some of the Pharisees know it. Yeah, because they were so sad, you see. Louise hadn't picked up that one before. There you are. You'll all go home and you'll remember that now, and it'll make you cringe a little bit. But Paul raises this question. He says, look, I'm actually on trial here because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. I'm a Pharisee. And that's true. He was on trial because he believed in the resurrection of the dead. He really did. Jesus had risen from the dead. He'd met him. Jesus had given him fresh orders to go and preach the gospel to the Gentiles. And suddenly what happened in the court case, what went on, was all the Pharisees swung onto Paul's side. Well, quite a number of them did, and said, well, we're with him. We believe in the resurrection. And perhaps an angel or a spirit has spoken to him. And the Sadducees, well, then the others, said, well, no, we're against him. And it just, well, it kicked off again. a brawl started, and the Roman centurion, feel for him. I mean, the Roman tribune, the commander, got a feel for him. He's like, oh no, here we go again. He has to send in the soldiers to rescue Paul. If you look at verse 10, he had to rescue Paul from being torn apart. That was Paul's tactics that took it to, you know, the flare off this time. It was Paul who said, well, let's raise the issue of Sadducee versus Pharisee, and then he gets caught in the middle of it. And in all the brawl, anything could happen. There's no soldier near him initially. It's not good tactics. What was going through his mind that night after another rescue from the Roman commander? Jesus is at work despite our dangerous tactics. Verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. I wonder, we hit the pause button. Have you gone about and had your own special tactics and your own plan to reach, I don't know, your family or friends with Jesus? You suddenly realize as you start sharing with Jesus that your plan actually isn't as good as you thought it was, and it begins to crumble into your hands. I don't know, we've got quite a few students here. Maybe, you become a Christian in your first year. You imagine the situation. You become a Christian in your first year at uni. Then you're heading home for the summer holidays, and you've learned lots of stuff at CU. You've learned lots of stuff at church and the student ministry at church. And last time you really engaged with your parents or with them for any length of time, you didn't believe in heaven and hell, but now you do. And they, your parents are not believers, and you know that judgment is over their heads. So you go home and over the pie and peas, first night at home, you know, strategy, got to tell them the truth. That's what Paul kept on saying in student ministry every Sunday, and Luke was always encouraging me with this as well. You know, just tell your family the truth. You know, Dad, I think you're going to hell. But suddenly things kick off, and your family hate you. And sometimes you don't have to go that far. You just go home having become a Christian, which is what happened to my wife, Tanya. Lovely family, but not believers. And suddenly the attitude is, oh, you think you're holier than us, do you? Well, no, I didn't say that. It's amazingly easy to get the strategy wrong. And we need to hear the words that Paul heard that night. Take courage. Jesus is bigger than our strategy. He's operating with our strategy. He's operating despite our strategy. Thirdly, Jesus is at work, and we have another unexpected, unsurprising rescue. The mob can't lynch him. That's what we've heard in the story. The Romans can't flog him. The council can't condemn him. So verses 12 to 13, a band of 40 men decide to get together. They make an oath not to eat or drink till they have assassinated Paul. Now this is really ratcheting it up, isn't it? 40 men in Jerusalem have vowed not to eat or drink. That means they want to do it soon, until he's dead. And they come up with a plan. They go to the leaders of the Jewish council and they say, look, we've got a plan. We've gone into an oath together. We're not going to eat or drink till we've assassinated Paul. So what we would like you to do is go to the Roman tribune and say, look, we're sorry, so sorry that we really mucked up the previous trial and it ended up in disarray and us having a fight with each other. We promise we won't have a fight again. We won't have a bundle this time, all right? But let's do it properly. Why don't you bring Paul back and we put him on trial properly and effectively? Okay? So they say to the Jewish council, why don't you go and ask the Roman tribune to do that? And then, you know, old Jerusalem, all these little back streets, rabbit warren of back streets going everywhere. While Paul is being brought through on these little streets, 40 of us appearing from nowhere, overrunning the Roman soldiers that are guarding him in a great big bundle. No one would know what's happening. Real fast, we can bang in there, hit him hard, kill him, leave him in a pool of messy blood, and we can disappear into all that rabbit warren of streets, and no one will be able to do anything about it. The Jewish council said, yeah, okay then, let's do that then. And so they do. That's going to be their plan. And then we hit a surprise in the story. In fact, we hit a couple of surprises from nowhere. And nowhere else do we hear about Paul having a sister, let alone a nephew. And this little nephew, he hears about the what's going on. And I don't know, we're not told how the nephew hears what's going on. Maybe he's kind of like Charles Dickens, Artful Dodger, kind of a geezer, you know, going around the city there. And he's always hearing what's happening on the street. And maybe that's the way he gets the news. I don't know. Or maybe one of the family are in the 40 men that once Saul dead. We don't know. But he just kind of comes in from nowhere. And he goes to Paul and he says, Paul, look, there's 40 guys and they really want you dead. And they've got a plan. And this is their plan. And so Paul says to the centurion, he's guarding him, look, would you take this young lad to the Roman Tribune because he's got some information. So the young lad goes to the Roman Tribune to tell the Roman Tribune what's going on. And the Roman Tribune, we read in Luke tells us, takes the young lad by the hand. Now, I guess, you know, we've got some Ben over here. Now, if I was a big Roman soldier, Ben's a little bit old for me to take him by the hand and lead him along. You know, you wouldn't do that, big Roman soldier and a lad that age. I think this is a little lad. And this big Roman soldier takes him by the hand on one side where no one can hear, and he has a little word with him, and he hears the news. And he says, thank you very much indeed. Now, don't go and tell anybody that. That's our secret. Okay? You scoot off, and I'll sort it from here. So, what does the Roman Tribune do next? Well, he gets together an armed guard, a bodyguard. Now, this is the Apostle Paul. He ends up, if you count the numbers up, he ends up with an armed bodyguard of 470 soldiers who take him off by night to Caesarea, the capital of the province there, to Felix, the governor, to be judged over that way. Who would have believed it? Jesus is overseeing his project to get his gospel to the world, to the center of the empire. Jesus really is in charge of what is going on. And we sometimes think, we limit God. Sometimes we say, well, you know, do you believe in a God of miracles? And if you don't see as many miracles happening now, we kind of like think, well, we're limiting God by not praying for more miracles. But we limit God by thinking that he's just a God of miracles. Now, he's the God, he's not just a God of the gaps, doing sudden exciting things here, there and everywhere. Earlier on in the book of Acts, we find that Peter is rescued from prison by an angel. Whacking great big wonderful miracle. Here, we find that Paul is rescued by a little nephew. And then 470 armed troops. Who would have thought it? Jesus is Lord of all. He's sovereign. That means he's in charge of absolutely everything. He's in charge of the amazing miracles. He's in charge of these little things as they go on. A little lad hearing what's going on. We don't know how. But God rescues his man to make sure that his mission to get the gospel out into his world happens. And so Jesus is at work. Another unexpected, unsurprising rescue. Verse 11. That night the Lord stood by Paul and said, take courage, for as you've testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. Just a couple of thoughts by way of application. Owen, can we just have the last phrase come up on the screen there? Take courage. That's where we're heading. That's the main thing I think take home for us this evening is take courage. The first thing, just to draw out, is prayer. The prayers of the church in Rome that we looked at the beginning will be answered. Paul will get there. God answers prayers about his work. And so I want to say a direct implication from this passage about prayers and answering prayers is come on Tuesday. Come to our monthly church prayer and praise. In Edgerton Hall, our own building on the other side of Devonshire Green then. Tuesday takeaway starts at 7 o'clock. Praying at 8. Come on Tuesday. God loves to hear and answer our prayers for his work. Secondly, Jesus is deeply involved in overseeing his work. We can trust him to keep his word. We can trust him to take his word to his world. And we must expect to experience the surprising and continual work of Jesus in all sorts of ways, as we hope and pray to plant a church into Walkley, as we hope and pray to see this building project completed. Both these projects are well beyond us, but not beyond Jesus. And they may not work out exactly how we want or desire or plan, but they will according to his plan. And we must trust him to be involved all the way through. And lastly, verse 11. Look at it again. Paul is lying there the following night. And what is going through his mind? You know, that night, you know, he must lick his fat lip. You know, he's taken a punch on the face. He must lick his fat lip. He's you're on. They've been beating him up, and he's had to be rescued from a lynch mob by soldiers. So he's badly bruised. He's hurting. Remember that to carry him up the stairs into the barracks in a previous section of the story. He's badly bruised. He's lying there. And what it's not just his bones and his face that hurts. We all know that phrase, English, is sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. We all know that ain't true. We all know the deeper lasting damage and pain and worrying concerns inside, in our thinking, in our hearts. What's going through Paul's mind as he lies there? Is he thinking back? All those people on my journey to Jerusalem, the number of people who said, don't go. Perhaps I should have listened. Perhaps I shouldn't come. People haven't listened to me here. They just wanted to kill me. You know, am I right to be here? And what about what I did in that council a moment ago? Was I really humbled when I shot back with my word, you whitewashed wall? Did I really say that to the high priest? He said, Paul's a Pharisee. Deep respect for the religion as it was. Did I really say that to the high priest? What's going through his mind? Does he think about the Roman tribune who keeps on popping up to rescue him? Does he think about his personal witness to him and say, well, I messed it up that time. What's my witness doing for that guy? And Jesus comes and stands by him and says, Paul, take courage. And it may well be that that's a word for you tonight. I think it's a word for us all, but it may well be there are some here tonight for whom it's a specific word. You just wonder where things are. What is it that keeps you up at night? What is it that worries you? What is it that concerns you about your walk with the Lord? About your witness for him. Maybe you need to hear that. And I'm going to encourage us. We're going to have communion in a moment. We're going to receive the bread and we're going to drink wine. We today, we're not going to have, I dare say, unless Jesus appears in glory now amongst us, I doubt that's going to happen. But we're not going to have that kind of like Paul experience of Jesus being there and saying words in that tangible way to us. This is a sacrament which Jesus told us to do in remembrance of him. And as you eat the bread and receive that this evening, as you drink the wine, remember, Jesus said, I've won the greatest victory for you. There's no bigger victory than the victory over sin and Satan and death and hell and judgment than this. So as you eat, as you drink, ponder Jesus saying to you tonight, take courage. Take courage. We're going to stand and we're going to sing our next song. It's one that we sung it for the first time ever as a church, and that was this morning. And it's an old-time song which many of us might know from ages ago. I think it's a great, great hymn, it's a great song with some fantastic words in it. It begins with stand up, say, would you stand?